Hey guys, before we get into the show, I'd like to take a moment to introduce our podcast partners, Script Up. Script Up is a new coverage service created to help screenwriters improve their writing and unlock the potential in their stories through detailed feedback reports and video call consultations. I have personally vetted their services, and I can honestly tell you they will provide a detailed analysis of your script, along with useful notes and even a biography of the reader, so you know exactly who is reading your script. Head to scriptupstudio.com and enter discount code TSN10 for 10% off today. And now let's get to the show. Hey guys, thanks for tuning in to the Screenwriters Network podcast. The Screenwriters Network is the largest Discord server of screenwriters in the world. And on this show, we usually interview members of our community. But today we have an extra special bonus episode introducing our first ever Professionals Roundtable. As you know, if you're a member of our server, we have quite a few verified professionals amongst us. These are members who either have representation, have sold their screenplays, seen them produced into films, won contests, etc. We recently hosted a live roundtable discussion featuring five of our verified professionals. The topic? Concept, selection, and exploration. How do you decide which ideas are worth writing? This episode is hosted by Hitlist writer Mark Mazur, who is also my first ever guest on this show and also a moderator on our server. I do apologize for the sound quality of Mark's microphone. I'll be honest, it kind of sucks, but he does do an awesome job of hosting this roundtable. About halfway through the discussion, the pros answer questions from members of our server. So if you're listening to this episode and have no idea what I'm talking about, it's probably time to join our Discord server, the Screenwriters Network. We'd love to have you join our community, and it's absolutely free. You'll find the invite link in our show notes. By the way, if you're listening to this episode in the far distant future, this was recorded during April of 2020 when the world was on lockdown due to the coronavirus. And now, without further ado, I bring you the first ever Professionals Roundtable.
Okay, so welcome everybody to the Screenwriters Network first professional roundtable. We have a handful of our professionals. So thank you guys for joining me. I'm going to introduce you. First up is Alex D. Reed. He's a screenwriter from Northern Ireland who specializes in writing horror. In 2019, he won the horror category at Austin Film Festival for his screenplay Delirium, and is currently studying for a PhD in English literature with a focus on the horror genre.
Hi, hello, welcome. I'm not that bad.
Susan E. Connolly is from Ireland, currently has five pilots under option, and is working on two adaptations of young adult novels to screen. Her work spans fields from paranormal police procedurals to contemporary teen dramas to near-future science fiction. Susan is also a qualified veterinary surgeon and recently completed a PhD in biostatistics at the University of Cambridge. At one point, she was the highest-ranked competitive debater in Ireland. Wow, that's quite the resume, Susan.
Hi, how are you? I have a very boring social life, is how that all happened.
Greg Bjorkman is a writer-director in Los Angeles. He co-wrote his first feature, Press Play, with writing partner James Batchelor, that was produced last fall by Parasite's financier, CJ Entertainment. It is currently in post-production. Prior to being a writer-director, he spent time in editorial working as a VFX editor, a VFX supervisor, an assistant editor on projects including The Fault in Our Stars and X-Men New Mutants. Greg is a member of the WGA West and DGA, and is only repped legally by Jacare Austin Tyreman. Greg, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I feel like I don't belong here, but let's talk.
And finally, Scott Barkin is a professional screenwriter based in Philadelphia. He and his writing partner, Greg Zettner, has produced features to their name in addition to having sold and optioned numerous original feature screenplays. Their psychological horror feature, I'm Just Fucking With You, was produced by Blumhouse and Hulu and premiered at South by Southwest in 2019 as a narrative spotlight feature selection. Their most recent spec, The Sun Always Sets in the West, is currently set up at Lionsgate with Danny McBride attached to produce and direct. Barkin is a member of the WGA East and is rep by Mainstay Entertainment and CAA until he fired them. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so today we are going to talk about the impetus of what we're all trying to do here, which is write. So it's about coming up with ideas and testing those ideas and kind of discovering how you know when you have that something special that is worth trying to make into something incredible as either a screenplay or a pilot. and hopefully eventually a film or a TV show. So the first question I have for all of you is, I want to focus on a project that you've had success with, something that has placed in a competition or been produced or optioned. And I want to know where that idea originally came from. Like, what was that first image that came to you, the first character that you met in your head, or the first log line, or what was the impetus of that idea? So Alex, we'll start with you. A delirium. What was the first idea? What was that first piece?
It's kind of two things, which immediately goes against the question that you just asked. I remember reading, I think it was in Stephen King's Bizarre of Bad Dreams, he talks about how when he gets a story, it's like two different divergent ideas that seem completely separate from each other, and then he puts them together. It's like, oh, there's a story there. Similar thing happened for Delirium. I've always been massively into Lovecraft stuff, and I was reading, I think I was making my way through his entire bibliography at that point. And then I happened to watch this YouTube video by a channel called The Art Assignment about like most remote art on planet Earth. And they talked about this place on Earth called Point Nemo, which I hadn't heard about before, which is the most isolated point you can be. Yeah, I think you're closer to the International Space Station than you are to any other people on planet Earth when you're at Point Nemo. And those two ideas seemed completely complementary. And yeah, it was kind of a pretty quick process after that. And that was kind of like, you know, set off the mark. And then after that, it came about pretty quickly.
So it's a conversion of two different ideas that kind of came together to form something new.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have tried Lovecraft stuff before and it didn't really work very well. I wouldn't say they're my best, or definitely not in my top 50% screenplays. They're probably in the bottom half. So I was kind of wary about stepping a toe in for a third time. And I think it was maybe that fresh idea or fresh location that gave me something more to work with than just, oh, I love this, and just fanboying for an entire script. Instead, I had something original to work into that.
Okay. And Scott, same question to you. One of your successes, either a screenplay that has been optioned or one that has been produced, where did that idea come from?
Well, yeah, figuring out concepts, I'd say, has been like one of the main things that me and Greg, my writing partner, have like really tried to crack. You know, I've been writing screenplays for going on 20 years now, and it was a long, long time before we wrote anything that, you know, anybody was really interested in, because we were, I would say, just writing the wrong things, even though we'd get a lot of positive feedback on the writing itself, but conceptually, you know, nothing was landing. And so we started trying to hammer down, you know, on how could we know before diving into something whether it was going to be, you know, a viable script for the marketplace a lot more after, you know, doing it for probably 10 years or so. And that sort of landed us in a spot where we started really focusing and thinking more about the budget of ideas and seeing the kinds of things that were getting produced, you know, on a large scale, in terms of like a lot of types of those movies getting made, and seeing to figure out, okay, well, everyone is sort of like going in this contained direction, or thrillers and horrors and things like that. And then, you know, deciding, okay, we're going to work towards that. But then the next step being, how can we contribute something to that space that hasn't been done already, I think is really like the key, being, you know, thinking about the budget and the size of the cast and the locations and stuff like that, and keeping that tamped down as much as possible, but then trying to zero in on like what are playable games that can happen in the movie that is not just going to be like, okay, well, this is a home invasion thriller, people are invading the house, and then all the same stuff is going to happen that happens in every other home invasion thriller. So, you know, like one example of this is probably what I would consider our break-in screenplay. It was a script that we wrote called Bleed, and we were basically like, we want to write a home invasion thriller, but we want to do something that we have never seen on screen before. And it really wasn't like a lightning strike moment. It was more just like brainstorming and brainstorming all different kinds of scenarios, and where we wound up was, you know, realizing that putting limitations, certain limitations on what our hero is able to do can open opportunities to things that we had never seen before in that kind of movie. And so we came up with this idea where the protagonist basically would have a knife in his heart the entire movie. And, you know, that comes from this sort of piece of, you know, like urban folklore or whatever, where they say if you get stabbed in the heart and you don't pull the knife out, you know, you can survive for a certain amount of time. So that was basically our conceit, was like, well, I've never seen a movie in a home invasion thriller where a guy is in that kind of predicament. And that allowed it to be a script where we had all these sort of tropes of the genre. You know, the plot didn't have to be mind-blowing. It only had to provide opportunities for this guy to play the game of having a knife in his heart and be bleeding to death. And so the whole, that sort of box that we had to play in gave it a set of limitations and gave it, a sort of certain direction it had to go in, because he can't, at that point, you know, he's not just running around punching and kicking people or shooting people. You know, we tried to make, well, we're not going to have real physical fights. And if we do have physical fights, they're going to be about how this knife in his heart is coloring that situation and stuff like that. So it gave it all these playable games in the second act that had very specifically to do with that. And then just making sure that the structure of it and everything else was done, you know, well, with the, what we always call the plus one on the, you know, the sort of home invasion thriller being this idea of the knife in the heart, got people really excited about it when we started sending it around. And so like that kind of thing is really what we try to do with all our concepts now, is like stress test them in this certain way where we're making sure we're not getting involved in writing something that it's going to have just like lead to a bunch of familiar situations, since it's instead going to go in the direction of something that we haven't seen on screen before. And that's sort of how we wound up at that idea, that first script that really opened up all the doors for us going forward from there.
And that's, I think that's something that I've seen more and more like out of professional writers, is finding this balance of seeing what is working in the market and where the market is going, and taking that a familiar idea with a new twist on it. And, you know, watching or reading Bleed and then seeing the film that it became, it very much still has that familiar feeling of a home invasion movie, but it has such that unique twist in it with the heart and the chest that it does, like you said, open up a lot of interesting scenarios that the character just has to do things differently than what you've seen in other home invasion films.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like the age old saying of, you know, the same but different, you know, that has been in Hollywood forever. But I think it's more important now than ever, because we are sitting on 100 years of cinema history at this point, and so many things have been done. So holding yourself to that really high standard of like, is, if I drill into this idea, am I really going to get new scenes and sequences that I'm not able to find in other movies in this genre? And like throwing away stuff that doesn't get you there, and being just like really, really hard on yourself about not giving in to the temptation of writing something that is going to be too familiar, I think is like so, so important.
There's a writer on Twitter, I can't remember if it was Ali Karsh or Jennifer Lynn Barnes, but it was one of them, who describes something kind of similar as, you have to find the ice cream in the ice cream sandwich. And the idea is, someone has an ice cream sandwich and they're like, they eat it and they're like, that was delicious. I'd like something like that, you know, different, but like that. And what they want is an ice cream sundae. They don't want a sandwich like a BLT, you know? Like, what they want is the ice cream with some different structure around it. And so it's really important when someone's like, I want something like this, but different, to identify what part of that is the ice cream and what part is the wafer.
I spent a long time in advertising, and it very much was a lot of the same of like, executives and companies wanted something that they've never seen before that they can then watch on TV that night.
Yeah, you know, I've used that analogy before, that the, from advertising, that idea of the unique selling proposition, right? Which is like, if there's that famous scene in the pilot episode of Mad Men when he tells them how he's going to sell the cigarettes. And it's because all the cigarette companies are the same, but how are we going to sell this cigarette company? It's toasted, right? Is the big thing that he comes up with. And it's such a great encapsulation of what you should be trying to do in screenwriting, is figuring out what is the unique angle on what you're doing. It's so much like advertising in that way.
So Susan, you have optioned 5 pilots. So from the outside, it looks like you're pretty tapped into what's hot right now. So what are you using to test those ideas as you develop something? What's your process there?
The way you kind of framed your opening question to Alex, before you asked Alex, it's a little bit difficult for me because all the projects I've had success with are currently under option to production companies, but not yet sold to a network or a broadcaster. And it's, producers get a bit tetchy when you say in a public channel everything about that show, right? So what I'll do is describe the process that I have, which is pretty similar, but I'll have to use something I haven't yet sold.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. So for me, the way it generally works is I read something or I'm talking to someone or I see something that to me is in some way interesting. And I think it's interesting. And then once I have that kind of interesting thing, I start thinking about a character or characters who would be interesting to kind of see in that situation. So the example I'll give is last year I read this article about the first commercial gene therapy treatment that was on sale in the States. And it cures an inherited form of blindness. And I was like, that's super cool. Except then I saw the price of it. Anyone want to guess what the price is?
I have no idea.
Yeah,
$1 million.
It's $300,000 per eye. And wow. And the per eye bit was what really made it interesting to me, not just $300,000, but $300,000 per eye. And so I was like, that's so interesting. I'm interested in, I'm a scientist by trade. I'm a socialist by morals. And so things like this to me are really interesting. So I was thinking about gene therapy and about gene therapy under capitalism and what this would mean. And my brain goes in different situations. So I was thinking about, blue blood and the concept of royalty and aristocracy being better than the regular people. And so then I'm like, well, what if that was actually true? Right? Because they can buy the gene therapy, So all this is interesting to me, but that's not a story, right? Because there's no characters involved yet. That's just a concept. So then I start to think about characters and characters that might be interesting. And so I'm thinking about maybe someone who isn't, a very wealthy person in this new world of gene therapy, but was one of the test subjects at the start. So got their gene therapy and, obviously got some cool super strength from it that she keeps secret, that whole situation. So I'm thinking about this is a character. I'm thinking about them being in debt to this company. I'm thinking about what the company might do otherwise. I'm thinking about escaped insane super soldiers and her having to hunt them down, But again, this is still concept. Because this is none of this is special. This is all very much, and a person could do this, a person could do that, but who is that person? So for me, what's always the most challenging? So that much of it so far, I have about 50 ideas in a file that's at that level of detail. And what makes it go from that into something that I actually start writing, so this whole thing of going from concept to actually doing a story, for me, it is 2 things. So one is the show I'm writing has to be a show I would want to watch right now. This whole coronavirus situation has made it kind of difficult because, a good amount of my ideas are kind of dark dramas. And I'm in no way here for dark dramas right now. Personally, I don't want to watch them, so I ain't going to write them. But the other thing that I need is I need to think of kind of a couple of scenes that tell me what kind of show it is, if that makes sense. So one of my shows that I did sell, it's a teen drama, very much in the vein of Gossip Girl or The OC, Pretty Little Liars, that kind of show. And I thought of, and normally happens about 2 in the morning when I'm trying to sleep, I thought of an argument between a mother and a daughter who we kind of hate the mom at this point, but then she comes out with this thing during the argument. I can't go into too much detail, which comes out with this thing in the middle of the argument, and you're like, yeah, we still hate her, but I kind of see where she's coming from at this point. And then when I had that scene, I could sit down and I could write the whole show because I knew what it was about at that point. What's interesting is that scene actually isn't in the pilot anymore. I had to take it out because it didn't fit, but it was that scene that made me able to write the pilot because then I understood what the show was. I don't know if any of that made sense from my stream of consciousness process, but that's what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the writing a scene to kind of uncover more ideas is something that I have also discovered, almost like scaffolding when you're working on a building. Like, you'll build up these scenes that eventually will be taken down to help shape into this the script that you're actually working to write on. And I think the idea of like finding different articles or news sources and then combining them with different ideas is a hugely smart way to come up with new ideas and create something new by combining different things. We have a related question from Meme God, and that is, how do you go about determining what kind of characters will best fit your initial concept? So I'm going to send this one over to Greg. Greg, your film Press Play it's a lot of fun, and it's kind of a new twist on a time travel movie. So I'm curious, you know, where that idea came from and then how you went about creating characters to fit within that world that Press Play is.
Well, the idea came to me about 8 years ago from a friend, actually. And it took me a long time to actually get to the point of writing it. I felt like I didn't have enough like life experience. I had to go through a couple relationships in order to get like the emotional firepower to be able to back the story, because it is a story that deals with characters losing things. And when I write characters, I have a cheat sheet. I have a list of character flaws or traits, and I've put them against each other. So like I have if a character's altruistic, the opposite trait of that would be selfish. And so I oftentimes put two characters in a scene that you know, have that opposite trait, because that's what makes it interesting. When you have two characters that are, you know, on the same side and they're trying to go after something, you know, that they both want, having two different traits that can accomplish adding some sort of drama to the scene helps. So like an example that I always give is, if you look at 22 Jump Street, you've got Channing Tatum's character and you've got Jonah Hill's character, and they both want the same thing. They're both trying to you know, be accepted. And also a specific scene I think of is when they're trying to break into the house and they're completely high, like the fraternity house, to spy on the people that they think are selling drugs. And you have Channing Tatum's character, you know, doing all these flips to get up to the second floor, and you got Jonah Hill's character, like, you know, taking this pulley system up. And the stark contrast between those two characters is seen, but they both want the same thing. So you add comedy element to it, but it also adds like, this is why these characters grow apart in the movie, and that's where like the conflict comes from, because they're so different. So when I sit down to develop a character, you know, I look at something that is relatable. I look at like, you know, some sort of situation that I can put them in. Like, what would you do if you could, you know, travel through time and save someone that you love? You know, what would you do if you had a second chance? Like, if you have a character that does something that's very relatable, and is put into a situation where, you know, you wish that you could be, that to me is where you can succeed in your writing, is by making the story relatable through your characters.
I've discovered as I was kind of rewriting one of my scripts this past week that having like the kind of the main question, the main dramatic question in your film answered by two characters, that if only they came together, they would be able to resolve this. And it's not until the end of the movie that they realize this is huge. And not only like giving this catharsis to the audience, but also creating these interesting arcs that these characters have to get through in order to solve that problem. So I definitely agree that kind of this dynamic pairs, as I'm going to steal from the technique thread, yeah, is a great idea. Yes. Moving over to like Barky, I'm thinking about Bleed, right? So you have a character with a knife in his chest, in his heart. How do you decide who that character is? And, you know, figuring out what is his story? Like, you have this high concept. How do you figure out this character around that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's as simple as asking yourself, you know, who is the worst person to be in that situation, you know? Mm. And that goes, I think, for almost any concept where, you know, where it's sort of goal oriented and pushing against some kind of conflict like that. In Bleed, you know, for example, we knew we didn't want a tough guy in that situation, because it was not going to be about fighting back the way like Die Hard is about fighting back in a movie like Die Hard. It's like the bad guys come and invade a contained space, and it's like, oh, they fucked with the wrong guy, you know, like, and we didn't want to do that in Bleed. We wanted it to be like, how is a guy, you know, who never would imagine himself in this kind of situation going to be able to overcome? So we knew he had to be a smart guy, but we also, because he's going to have to basically outsmart these guys and figure out a way to survive in, you know, with this knife in his heart. We had to give him a little bit of medical expertise, we felt, because, you know, it is a medical situation, but it would have been too on the nose for him to be, you know, a surgeon. So we made him a skin doctor, a dermatologist. Dermatologist. and we made him afraid of blood. And we pitted him against his brother, which in the original script, it's his brother. Something's changed in the final product, which I won't get into. But and his brother was a big, tough guy who was prepared for some kind of confrontation like this. And so we wanted it to seem like almost playing the game with who is going to be the hero in this story. We think it's the tough brother, but it's actually the terrified brother who becomes the hero, you know. So things like that, of just going against the expectation and making it a situation where you know, it is a person who is the least likely candidate to get out of this thing alive, you know. And we did the same thing in our other movie, I'm Just Fucking With You. You know, that's a movie where one of the characters is baked into the concept, where it's about a very pushy guy, this kind of guy that we've all, you know, probably run into on occasion in a bar, where they just will come up to you and start talking to you and, you know, start making jokes and making you feel uncomfortable and then be like, I'm just fucking with you. We knew we had that guy because the whole script is based around that guy, like the worst possible version of that guy. And so that character was obvious, but then it was the same thought process of, well, who's the worst person to wind up having to deal with that kind of guy? And it's a person who is very nebbish and closed off and a germaphobe, and the last thing they want is to interact with anybody. They just want to be left alone, you know. And so from figuring out those dynamics, it becomes clear how you can have this push and pull between the character and the situation, or the character and, you know, whoever the other main characters are in the story.
So I have an opinion.
Let's hear it.
I would like to share. So I think Barky's dead right. You know, having this kind of like, who would be the worst person to put in this situation is like such a gold for conflict and drama and things like that. Where it can get a bit dangerous is where people go, well, who would hate to be in this situation? And they put that person in there without doing a lot of thought on it, or they don't even think that. And they're hung up on this idea of like the reluctant hero, this idea that you have to have the hero refuses the call. because if you have to do a lot of work to make that refusal of the call make sense, right? Because otherwise you get into two problems, both of which are illustrated actually by a show that I love, which is Teen Wolf, where you have like this guy Scott who gets bitten by a werewolf and now he's a werewolf, right? There's no real downsides to being a werewolf. You're just suddenly like really like attractive to the girl you like and really good at lacrosse that you care about for some reason. So then when he's like, oh, I wish I wasn't a werewolf, you're like, why though? Being a werewolf's great. You have no evidence that there's any problem with being a werewolf. It's been like nothing but gold for you. So it just doesn't make a lot of sense, right? The other problem, and I think one that's like actually kind of more important, right, is we're all there to watch a show called Teen Wolf. Like, we're all here for werewolf shenanigans, right? That's what we're here for. And your main character is running away from werewolf shenanigans. And so the guy who's meant to be his sidekick, Styles, who's like, I'm doing some research on werewolves. Here's a lot of stuff about werewolves. I'm really interested in werewolves. He becomes much more compelling to us as a viewer. And so then you're a little bit confused because your sidekick character is more popular than your main character. And you end up having to do this like rejig around episode 4. So I think it's just really important to think who would do badly in this situation is kind of quite distinct from who would not want to be in this situation. Like, both can work, but you just need to be quite careful about them. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I think Craig Mazin said something, it's a little bit vague, but I think it's helpful. It's not who would hate to be in this situation, but what is the most interesting character to be in this situation and to think about it ironically. I wish I could come up with a good example off the top of my head. Whiplash is a great example. You know, you've got a character, can't remember his name, loves jazz, and then the entire story is essentially about trying to make him hate what he loves. And you could stick, you know, just a generic musician into that story, but that protagonist, you know, he just doesn't like jazz. He is obsessive about it, which makes the entire story far more interesting than if it were just, I don't know, trombone player number 2 in the same room. You know what I mean?
If you look at Finding Nemo, the dad fish, right? He hates being in the situation, obviously, leaving the reef, but he's incredibly motivated to dive headfirst into that situation. He's driving story at all times, you know? He's not trying to not be out of the reef. He's goal-orientated to finding his son, which also works. He hates being there, but he will totally definitely be there, you know? You just don't want people running away from story ever.
Well, I think there's also a difference, you know, back to your Teen Wolf example, what you might do in a TV show versus what you might do in a movie.
For sure.
You know, like the feature version of Teen Wolf, the original one, you know, there is a classic refusal of the call, because when he finds out he's a werewolf, it's scary. He doesn't know what's happening to him, and so he, you know, he doesn't understand the potential benefits of it yet, and it's a resistance and a fear that grows out of that discovery. But then that's only, you know, a brief sequence in the film, and then when you go into act 2, that's when he is like, oh, actually this is going to be fun, and then we get those funny type of thing works pretty nicely, whereas in a TV show you might not want that same resistance.
Well, yeah, it's also about order, right? So like in the TV show, he is really good at lacrosse and everything before he realizes he's a werewolf. He's seen all the benefits and no downsides before he is a werewolf, and then you're like,
yeah, that's
why
weird.
Why do you care, dude? Like, this sounds amazing. I'd love to be a werewolf, you know?
Totally.
So like, order is really important there.
It's about finding this balance of creating a character that has to go through hell with your film, but also has to go through it. Like, I imagine if I got stabbed in the heart, I would probably just lay down and die. But having a doctor that knows a very basic something is enough of a push that, like, theoretically they could continue to do, you know, to move forward.
I would love to talk about Finding Nemo for a second, because that's a perfect example of you know, having something that in the opening scene we find out about you know, this dad fish and why he's so protective of his son,
Marlin, that's his name.
Yeah, Marlin. And, you know, he loses all his whole family except for one fish. And so he has, and then that's why he's so protective. Like, we as an audience relate to him because, you know, we can see that he's, you know, got a reason to be, you know, super protective of his son. And the son obviously hasn't been through enough life to understand. So we can relate to that little guy too. But then we also have that call to action where he has to go out of his way to save his son because it's his son. And that's like that growth of a character learning how to you know, be a better fish is the growth that I think that all Pixar and Disney movies stick to, and why they're so popular, because we as an audience member can relate to the characters, we can cheer for them to change and grow, and they're relatable. Like, it's a relatable story that gives us that warm feeling at the end, because, you know, that character changes and we're able to watch it happen, because that gives us hope in our own lives, because we leave the theater as an audience member who sees opportunity in change. And I think that's why a lot of people go to film, because they want to escape their own lives and go on a journey that allows them to see possibilities. Maybe they can change.
I mean, Finding Nemo is like also a great kind of example of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, right? That life beyond the reef is scary. Life beyond the reef is valuable. And we learn at the end, yes, there are dangers out there, but it's also valuable. You know, like, neither dad fish nor son fish was entirely wrong in this situation, do you know? Which I think is nice.
So we're going to take a couple user questions here. So if you do have questions, get them in the technique channel. The first question is from Emerska. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. What are the most important questions to ask yourself when you're trying to discover whether a concept has legs? So whether a concept is able to sustain a TV show or a feature film, what are these questions that you ask yourself to make sure that that this thing is worthy of spending, you know, months or years working on?
Don't avoid the second act. The third act's fun to think about, and the first act's fun to think about. Don't just, you know, don't just start the concept and think, oh, I'll get to the second act when I get to the second act. The second act is, you know, it's the fucking movie. You've got to... That is the core of what your idea is going to be. So, in fact, forget Act 1 and Act 3. If you can't figure out what exactly is going to happen in the guts of your script, and if your premise doesn't have the legs to get through an entire second act with every emotional arc that goes through there, I don't know if it's got legs. You know, I mean, I've tricked myself sometimes with an idea. I'm very guilty of like overdressing my ideas. I've got like, oh, this is cool, and this is cool, and this is cool. Throw it into a big old pot, and then it turns out the things that I find are cool are not necessarily substantive. They're just, you know, it's like any wallpaper you'll find on the internet. It's like nice to look at it first, but you'll get dead sick of it after a while because there's no depth. And I feel like if you can get your premise through a second act that doesn't feel labored and has a pretty fast pace, then I think your premise has legs. The first act and third act, that's easy stuff. If you can get it through the second, you're golden.
I agree.
I always, for me, this comes back to that idea of games, which for me, you know, like pretty much everything I write and my writing partner and I write together become about what are the games that we're going to be able to play with this concept. And, you know, the first thing we do to sort of stress test is just create a big list of all the different things that we would like to see happen. And I agree, it's completely about what goes on in the second act. And when we have enough stuff in there where, regardless of where it might happen in the script, but we could just see that there's a bounty of ideas that are not things that are going to feel familiar to other movies, then we can start interweaving that with, you know, some kind of structural elements and figure out, well, how are these going to become sort of tentpole moments in the script? And is there enough to carry us through without having to fall back on sort of you know, more predictable or obvious scenes that we have seen before. And then once we have all that, like, regardless of, you know, this very specific plot developments, but then we can safely move forward and be like, okay, there's enough here to justify diving into this, because there's clearly many, you know, sequences and moments that we're excited about playing with.
So it's a little more complex in TV, because it kind of depends on whether your show is kind of procedural and or episodic, or whether it's more serial. The phrase that tends to be used is what's the story engine? So for something like a police show, you know, or a medical show, the story engine is very clear. It's who did the murder? A murder has happened. Who did the murder? Do you know? Or who, a medical show, it's like a disease happened. What's the disease or whatever, right? Where it gets a little bit more complex is where you have kind of semi-episodic or serial shows. But it's also kind of workable. So like the story engine for Breaking Bad is Walter White is trying to make and sell meth, and it turns out it's kind of difficult, right? Or even for something like The Sopranos, it's like the story engine is how do you, you know, control your mob empire while also dealing with your anxiety. Do you know what I mean? Or for like a drama, like it can be something as simple as like, who's he going to kiss, you know? But that's your story engine. And when you break it down like that, like it seems like most shows are kind of the same. And you'd not be wrong. Do you know what I mean? And this is part of why I always have a big problem trying to sell something with a synopsis or a pitch or something, because a lot of shows are, when you break them down, broadly similar. What makes them special is hopefully what we're bringing to them as writers. You know, what's showing happening through the dialogue and the scenes and the characters, and what makes us want this guy to kiss that specific girl more than anyone else. And that can be very hard to bring across in a synopsis or in your pre-thinking. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So sucks. It's hard.
I think you've got the harder job out of most of us. I really do.
I agree. I think that when I write something, I look at the end goal, like where do I want to end up? And then, you know, I don't have 10 or 20 episodes to have to worry about how do I get there.
Well, I mean, like for spec or whatever, you actually don't have to worry about those 20 episodes. Like you should have an idea, but just you want it to be that the end of the pilot, you know, if it's some kind of kissing, you want to have people at the end be like, who's he going to kiss? You know, you want them excited to find out more, or you want them to be like, oh, I can't wait to see how they solve another murder, you know, or you want them to be like, man, is she going to find out about those evil dolphin spies? Who can say it? You know, you want to make the end of the pilot be something where someone's like, that was amazing. I can't wait to see more of that. And once you get to that point, you know, then the synopsis is easy because they're already invested. And so they're reading the synopsis for the rest of the season, invested in your characters and your concept. But I think it can be very difficult, you know, without an example of your writing of what the actual script would look like to right. get that through in a synopsis.
So our next question,
for comedy. Oh my God. Sorry.
No, our next question is from Broder. What do you focus on when brainstorming new story ideas? Is it a unique premise that you become intrigued by, or is it a premise that you feel you are the appropriate person to write? So I think, like, if you are developing ideas, come up with ideas, are there ideas that you don't think you're the right person to write and you let go of? Or if you are simply intrigued by it, whether it's a new genre for you, are you going to dive into that if it really is that gripping?
That's a
I'll probably sound like I'm beating a dead horse, but I am really all about just like figuring out what are going to be the scenes that are not going to be like derivative of other similar movies in the same genre. To me, it's the most important thing. And then like we were talking about before, building out characters and stuff from there. But when I am trying to suss out, you know, is this premise gonna do it for me? That's what I have to do. I just have to know there's a significant number of moments that are just feeling like a fresh spin on this genre.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever feel it's going to make me sound like an egotist, but I don't think there's any story ideas that I come up with and take seriously that I don't feel that I'm appropriate for, if that makes sense. Yeah, you know, same. I feel like if I come up with that idea and I seriously consider it for more than 10 minutes, it feels like something it's came out of my brain, so I could probably do something. I mean, there's a, you know, I have thought of like a comedy idea every now and then, but I rarely consider it for more than 5 or 10 minutes because I know I'm not good at writing comedy, and I know what I've just come up with is a gag at best. It's not an entire script. So I can't say I fully relate to having an idea that I don't feel appropriate for, but I mean, does anyone disagree? So
I definitely have. I have come up with ideas that where I would say were kind of had a racial component to them that after thinking about them for a little bit of time, I was just like, you know what? I'm not the right person to be trying to tell this story.
Sure.
Yeah. Or like sometimes I'm like, you know, I probably could, or I could like seek out a co-writer or something, but it would be an awful lot of work that I could fuck up. Like, remember when I was 10, I watched the episode of Captain Planet that's set in Belfast, where the IRA steal a nuclear weapon and plan to show up Belfast, and Captain Planet solves like the troubles in the north. And I was just like, the fuck is this shit? Like, and then there's like that episode of Buffy that's like Angel in Ireland and like in his youth. Mm. And I was just like, oh my God, shoot me now. This is the worst. Like, but obviously the people writing those episodes, like they thought they'd done their research and they thought like what they were doing was grand. But like, I'm like, I fucking hate you. Or like anything that's written, that's set in Ireland, that's about fairies, that is entirely about like the Shakespearean concept of fairies and the British concept of fairies, which is like just not how we do shit here, right? There are not like winter courts and summer courts and they're like these cool aristocrats. Like fairies are fucking freak ass weirdos. And the moral of every Irish fairy story is like, just don't go near them, lads. Just, it's not worth it. Don't do it. You could get a bag of gold or you could get your legs chopped off. No one knows why. And it just pisses me off, like, and like, not doesn't make me upset and whatever, but like, it pisses me off enough that I'm like, do I want to get into this minefield and make someone else annoyed with my show? Like, probably not. Like, if I had a show that was like on the air and I had a cool idea and I had a budget to bring in a couple of writers with like better perspectives on the issue, I'd definitely do it, you know? But for right now, writing specs, I just think it's a waste of my resources.
Yeah, let me retract my statement somewhat. In a cultural context, yes, I 100% agree with what you're talking about. I mean more like if I come up with ideas, like I'm never like, oh, that idea is too good for me. I'm not even going to try.
Oh, yeah, none of that shit.
You know, I will take a stab at it.
So, Alex, you're kind of a horror writer. You've had a lot of success in the horror realm. Are you going to sit down and write a rom-com, or is it something that you don't develop ideas?
It's
or...
not even something that I'm a little bit fucked in the head, but it's not even something, or if I'm coming up with ideas, it's not ever something that really occurs to me. Maybe, you know, Alex 5 years from now is going to be entirely different, and that is where my headspace is going to be at, but I feel like just the headspace I'm in is always looking for horrific stuff.
I think it seems cliche, but if you don't like what you're writing, you shouldn't be writing it. Like I would want to see every movie that I write. You know, like you want to sit down and go to a movie that you'd like to see. I think that should be like your goal, is to write what you like. Like, don't write something just because you like the concept. I think that if you don't like it, maybe there's a different a way to tell the story, but you know, at the end of the day, if you don't like what you're writing, then maybe you should write something else.
Yeah,
I think that is like an issue that, you know, people have with sort of chasing trends, and I feel like I see it a lot where, you know, everybody is thinking horror and thriller and contained stuff like that is like that's a way in, and that's true. But if you're not a person who just loves watching those movies and, you know, like is trying to see every one of those movies, whether or not you were trying to write one, then that's not going to be a way in for you, because it's not going to come across on the page that your enthusiasm for that genre.
And you can tell there's passion.
My next question is a little bit of theater of the mind here. We're going to exercise our brains for a second. Ooh. All right. So we're going to imagine that our concept is a rocket sitting on a launch pad ready to go. And you're in charge, you're NASA. And in front of you have the checklist that is the go, no go, determining whether or not you're going to take this concept and start outlining, start writing, whatever that next step is. What is on your checklist? What are all those boxes that need to be green before you start like saying, this is the idea I'm going to go with?
I thought you meant literally we're writing a story about a rocket on a...
Yeah, I bags it. No one can have that idea. It's mine now.
A beginning and an ending are essential to me. I'm big into tentpole outlining. So I don't do like page by page, this is what exactly is going to happen. But I always know the beginning. I always know the ending. And sometimes the midpoint. That's like top of the list for me.
Same. I think
I actually often don't have an ending.
Yeah, endings are for suckers. Sorry, Greg.
I envy you, man. I do.
I just need characters I care about. Not necessarily like, but care about, who want something and a reason they can't have it.
I think on the point of having an ending.
Oh, sorry, Greg.
No worries. I think on the point of having an ending, if you have a moral of the story, that's good enough for me. Like I want to learn something from it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't need to know like exactly what like the physical manifestation of the ending is, but it, like having a character goal is super important. And like what you're trying to say with it in some way, though that often changes during the process, I find, but at least having enough of an idea to feel like you're not going into writing something that just feels like it's just events that happen across time that have no bearing, you know, beyond them. But for me, I'm also thinking a lot about, you know, like I said before, I'm thinking a lot about saleability. I'm thinking a lot about, you know, are there roles that actors will want to play? That's something that, you know, I never used to think about. And then I found with all of my like more recent sales and interest, you know, that I've gotten, has so much of momentum that has gotten behind a script is because an actor read it and wanted to play the part that was in it. And then since I've started taking note of that, making sure that I have parts in my stuff that are going to be attractive and just sort of meaty roles for actors to dig into, and that there's a path to production. Like I can point to other comps in the marketplace, you know, say, well, this is another movie that was in this scope, in this genre, in this, you know, sort of cast size, location, whatever, that was successful, you know, and hopefully there are several, you know, but I see that a lot too with, you know, amateur scripts that I read, where it's really hard to point to a comp in the marketplace that where a person could say like, well, it's like this, but I've added this little twist to it or whatever. And I think more people thought about that, they would have, you know, more success, and it wouldn't just be sort of writing something that's just for them. I think that's a trap I fell into a lot in the early days of my career, was we were writing stuff that was just for us and we thought was funny or interesting or whatever, but like couldn't really point to other movies that existed that would represent evidence that anyone else would be interested in it.
There's a scene in the movie that I wrote with my writing partner that didn't exist until after we had gone out to a couple actors for the lead, and then also the second number two on the call sheet as well. But we were still looking for like for another actor for a role, and to that point, making a character attractable, like having an actor want to play that part, I think is important, because I don't think that without this specific scene that I'm thinking of, I don't think that we would have gotten Danny Glover to play that character, because it's such a unique scene. It didn't need to be in the movie, but it kind of helped facilitate that moral of the story that we wanted to implement into our audience's minds. And I think without that, I don't think we would have gotten Danny, and we wouldn't have been able to make that character as relatable. So I would say also that, you know, you have to kind of just not like you want to make characters interesting no matter what, but like you want to think about like, all right, is this going to be a fun character for this actor that I have in mind while I'm writing this to play?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good thinking point, right? If no one would want to play this character, does anyone want to watch them? Do you know, could they be replaced by a sexy lamp? Quite possibly.
Yeah, I think that's something that I've recently, as you know, I went through this option agreement and the subsequent rewrites, there's been a heavy focus on like, we need to bolster that protagonist to get an A-lister interested in him. And I think putting on your producer's hat, even for a few moments of like, okay, what are the scenes in this movie that people are going to see in the trailer that are going to get people to go to the theater or I guess watch it at home now. And finding those characters that those A-listers are going to want to play because they look cool, because they have interesting dilemmas, or you know, if you're not a director, what are the scenes that a director is going to go get excited about and be like, wow, this is something that I haven't quite seen or something that I haven't done before that I'd love to stick my teeth into.
Well, that's also another point to mention is that when actors audition for roles, they're only sent one scene or maybe two or three scenes max. Like they're reading based on just this scene. And if that character has, you know, like some fun, like meatiness to it, they're able to excel in that audition, and you'll be the director will see like what this character is that the actor is bringing to the table. So you know, just keeping that in mind, like when you're writing a scene, you know, if there's a character at their core, this is who this character is, and we can see it in a specific scene, that would benefit your writing, I think.
Yeah, like the concept of like thinking about a Disney I Want song for your characters, and do you have a scene that fills that same role, is something that I think is really useful. You know, if anyone doesn't know, the concept of every Disney main character has their I Want song that they sing, where they say, this is what I want, right? So like Mulan's is Reflection, do you know? And it just very clearly is like, this is what this character wants. Then you don't let them get it, and then they end up getting it. Hooray. And it's just interesting in films that aren't musicals to be like, is there any moment where this character and what they want is in any way clear whatsoever? Which would be the song scene? And if you don't have it, is it because you don't know what the character wants? Because if so, that's a problem.
I want to be a writer. Sorry, go ahead.
Moving on, we have time for a couple more questions. Our next one is from McCrushin. Do you ever use writing prompts to help you find concepts to explore? And if so, what are your favorite writing prompt resources?
No.
For me, writing other movies and are writing prompts. It's just, I often will see stuff and be like, I really would have liked that if they had gone in this direction or that direction. And then I'm like, oh, well, maybe I'll just do that thing that this was almost what I wanted it to be. So I'll make the thing that I wanted it to be. You know, those are sort of the writing prompts.
Yeah, I do the same thing. And I think earlier when you were talking, I thought about this as well. I was like I use examples when I'm writing with my writing partner. And I'll say, you know, it's kind of like this scene is kind of like this scene from this movie. So it's like doing your research on what's available out there to you, and like a general public, I think is very helpful. Like I don't use prompts. I use, you know, that feeling of like, I wish that this movie had this to it, to help facilitate some of the story elements in what I write.
Go ahead.
Like I'll often do like comparison stuff. Like, you know, I'd be like, oh, do you remember that scene in Hanayuri Dango where he's like running through the rain, try and rescue her? Like that's the role I want this scene to have. That's the feeling I want people to get, you know. Or in the OC, when Seth and Summer do the upside down kiss, you know, like, that's, I want people to feel that way in this scene. So I'll often have like that in mind for something kind of specific, but not like writing prompts in that way specifically.
Yeah, I know there's a subreddit for r/ writing prompts, and I hope this isn't a hot take. I kind of hate it. Like, I haven't read one there that has sparked any creativity in me. I really do think that, you know, if you're trying to develop concepts, you've got to be like a sponge for everything around you. Don't limit yourself to just movies. Play video games, read books, look at art, go outside every once in a while if you can. You know, explore everything outside. I mean, BBC News is a better writing prompt machine than r/ writing prompts, you know. I think you should just be absolutely open to everything that you can possibly extract from. I don't think I've got very many of my ideas from reading a script or watching a movie. Some, granted, but most is from the outside world. Like, Susan, you were saying earlier about that article about the eyes and the therapy for treating blindness. I mean, if you weren't open to that influencing your own creativity, then you may never have came across that idea.
I will say this in defense of writing prompts is I used to use them as like an exercise. So sure. I try to write every single day. So on days that I don't feel the momentum or the desire to dive into my current project, I might go flex my muscles with a writing prompt or dive up a loser or something, just to continue to get that mind working and the gears, you know, moving.
For different people, you know, different people have different ways, you know. So I could certainly imagine it being helpful to someone. They've never been helpful to me. But I also think it's worth saying another thing I do is go the opposite direction, where when I have an idea, and I know some people purposefully don't do this, but I tend to watch every single movie or read everything that I can find that is even remotely in the ballpark of what I'm trying to do. So it's almost like a reverse prompt to like trying to see what has already been done in that space and make sure that there's like no stone unturned. So that way, one, I can get ideas from those movies and see how they handled similar plots or concepts, but also so I can avoid, you know, retreading things that have already been done. And if you're like fully aware of everything that's out there, you know, to a reasonable degree, obviously it's impossible to see every single thing, but sometimes I have concepts where I can't even find movies that have been made that even feel close. And then I'm like, well, now I'm really onto something because there's nothing out there, you know? But I think that's valuable too, going sort of the other way. And once you have an idea, and just make sure that you're not doing something that someone has already done.
Or you do it again because it's so great. Like,
yeah. That's why I'm working on my Dinosaur Island movie.
Yeah. You're just like, and I want it again, guys. This is no longer cliche. This is just like awesome.
So I have one more question and then we'll start to wrap things up here. This one is from KT Guard. How important is momentum? You have an idea pile and one really sparks. Once you commit to running with it, how much time on average do you take from starting to finishing the draft?
Oh my god.
For a first draft. I think I'm going to make people feel bad. I'll wait to the end.
Okay. Well, I spend a lot of time personally developing an idea before I actually sit down and start writing it, but once I start writing it, it's pretty quick. I'm currently working on a Western with a writing partner, and we're just developing the idea. But as soon as we have like all of our pieces in place, it probably will take us less than 2 weeks to write the thing. Probably less than, probably even less than that. But it's mainly about setup, because once you get all the parts in the right place, it's like building a car. Like, it just goes.
For me, 100% agreed. I mean, momentum is fickle. You can't really rely on it, but I can 100% relate to. I also go pretty fast. Once I have everything in place, I love that idea of assembling a car. It just kind of goes. It just kind of goes after a while. I don't know. Momentum's nice, but you know, there will be days when it's going to fail on you, and that's where discipline comes in.
You know, I also take those days where, you know, I don't put a lot of pressure on the writing, because I realize that like some of the best ideas that you can have come from when you're just fucking around. Like, I can't tell you how many scenes my writing partner and I have written, and lines of dialogue we've come up when we've just been like, you know, shooting the shit, doing nothing. Like, we'll oftentimes like be playing video games together. Like, our writing sessions are basically playing video games together, like playing Smash Bros. Or
I love it. I love it.
Like just doing stuff that like takes the pressure off of your creativity is huge, and I think it takes you a long way.
Yeah,
I like that.
So once I type like begin teaser or whatever, from that to first draft for an hour long pilot is generally about 2 days. But I will put a big caveat on that, which is like I'll go months without writing a pilot because I don't know what it's going to be yet. And the other caveat is, so I have an RSI, so a repetitive strain injury in my shoulder. So typing actually hurts me like quite significantly. So I have to make sure that when I'm writing this, that the writing is good. I'm not going to be able to do 10 drafts or, you know, write a 200 page pilot and then cut it down like for my own actual physical health. So that's kind of how I end up in that situation.
It's kind of poetic.
Yeah, quite. Yeah. For me personally, I try to write as quickly as possible because otherwise I let myself start poking holes in the idea and then I start telling myself that it sucks without it even being a thing yet. So the quicker I can get it out, the more likely I am to not hate myself.
Yeah. It's interesting. I feel like we are trying to poke holes in our ideas. You know, like I don't worry too much about momentum. I mean, I guess part of it is being in a rhythm of writing every day, I think is super important. And that sort of negates the idea of needing momentum. It's just me and my writing partner write every day for, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 hours, depending on what we're working on or what our schedules are. But knowing that we're just doing it every day, regardless of what we're working on, kind of takes the pressure off. And then somehow, you know, we put a lot of time into outlining and poking holes and trying to figure out in that process before we get to script, are there holes to be poked, you know, and is it going to start to fall apart? So that way, when we get to the script stage, all that stuff is worked out, you know. So we have very detailed outlines, and then writing the script tends to go pretty quickly from that point. But yeah, you know, I don't think we ever really sit and think about like, we're on a roll now, let's just keep going. I mean, maybe occasionally, but we know the next day we're going to be in it for, you know, 4 hours or whatever, no matter where we are in the process. So it just sort of that,
how often,
you know, rhythm takes over
on Skype.
What's that?
Scott, how often do you just sit there on Skype with Greg and just, there's just silence when you guys are just thinking?
Cause a lot of the time. Hours. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like I've been going through that a little bit just because we're all in quarantine, writing from afar. And like oftentimes I'll just be sitting there. I'll be like, oh yeah, we're on FaceTime.
Yeah, well, our refrain is always after about 10 or 20 minutes of silence, one of us will be like, what are we thinking about again right now? but for us, it's actually, you know, I live in Philadelphia and he lives in Queens already. So we've been doing this over FaceTime forever. So this whole situation right now with the quarantine hasn't really impacted us, which is good. But it's something that you definitely get used to, and I think it's probably the best thing we've ever done for our career is commit to daily writing sessions of a certain length. And you know, some days we get together and nothing happens, and we bullshit for the whole time and we don't make any progress on anything, and some days we'll write 20 pages of something and you never know how it's going to go. But just showing up, and I think it's also one of the benefits of having a writing partner, is you're committed to that person. If you don't show up, you're letting them down. If they don't show up, they're letting you down. So I think it's invaluable. Not that obviously people write on their own and they find ways to do it. I personally, I don't know if I would find the commitment, but you know, but that keeps our sort of momentum going, is just our commitment to each other more than anything.
I actually picked up in interesting analogy from my dog. He has discovered what the sound of the carrot bag is. So if I take the carrots out of the fridge, he knows exactly what that bag sounds like. And every single time he shows up to get a carrot, and he loves carrots, but he doesn't get a carrot every single time, but he still shows up every single time. So I think going through that habit every single time, and sometimes you get the carrot, sometimes you don't, but he shows up every single day to get that carrot. And I think that's something that we can... What's that?
Do you think he's let down when he doesn't get a carrot? Because I think that if you put so much pressure on that carrot, then maybe you're not going to get a carrot ever.
I don't know if he gets let down, but I'll say this. Regardless of whether or not he gets a carrot, he shows up next time. And so, you know, so I think there's something we said about always sitting down to write and not putting pressure on the results, but just the action of doing so.
I love it.
Okay, so let's start to wrap things up here. I have one final question for you guys, but before that, I just want to do a couple quick shout outs. Barky, your script Bleed is available in the Script Hub. So if anyone wants to read that, that is out there.
I'm Just Talking With You is also in there. If people want to.
Oh, awesome. And Always Fucking With You is available on Hulu. If you'd like to watch that, I'm Just Fucking With You. Alex, I believe Delirium is in the Script Hub. Do you have anything else out there that people can read or watch?
I didn't even know it was in the Script Hub.
I don't know.
Alex is going to call his lawyer.
No, it's fine. I've got a website, alexdreed.com. You can read it there. I've got everything up there if you are so inclined to be such a masochist. Other than that, no, I'm just hanging out, dude.
And Great Press Play is in post-production, hoping to see that later this year, early next year. Anything else that we can read or watch of yours that's out there?
Nothing. This one was my first one. We'll see what I can do from here.
And Susan, anything of yours out there that we can read or watch?
No, there's nothing. It's all under Andre's. It might even be lies. Like, I have no pilot's options. It was all jokes, you know? Oh, you can read
it was
book
the confidence
that I did the film adaptation of, but the script isn't out yet, if you want. But it's a really good book. It's called Bear Mouth by Liz Hyder. So there you go. It's about a Victorian coal mine. There you go.
So my last question for all of you is, what are you currently reading or watching? What books, what TV shows, what movies have you watched recently or read recently that you enjoyed?
I watched Tiger King the other day.
Yeah, I've heard that one's pretty it's pretty hot right
but
now.
Also, yeah, Ozark is also really good. I love that show. I'm going to take flack for this, but I think that Ozark's better than Breaking Bad.
Oh, shit.
Hot take.
Yeah. Alex. Sorry, I'd already left the room. Are we still doing this? What am I reading? I just picked up Kafka on the Shore, Murakami's Kafka on the Shore again. I gave up 5 years ago, but I've kind of rediscovered a love for his work, so I've been enjoying that. What did I watch? I watched Wreck, I think it was a Spanish 2007 horror movie two nights ago. I don't know. Time is dilating in quarantine. Point is, I really enjoyed it. I'm stupid and I'm trying to read more Shakespeare. That's the most pretentious thing I could have said.
Susan, what about you?
So watching wise, I'm re-binging Travelers on Netflix, which is by Brad Reich, who did Stargate, which is this super cool, weird body possession, future time travel show, which is ace. Reading wise, my friend Katie wrote this like romance novel about a billionaire who can shapeshift into a bear and also cage fights. It's glorious, called Gladiator Bear by Katie Murphy. And my friend Sarah does the tie-in novels for The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. The latest one just came out last month. So I'm also reading that.
And Barky, finally. Scott, what about you?
What have I been watching? You know, lately and during this whole pandemic, somehow me and my girlfriend have just been binging Shameless, which I had never watched before. And is... quite a show. At least three seasons in, it's pretty insane. So apparently there are 9 seasons, so it's quite a ride that we're going to be on. So that's something I've been enjoying. And then probably that show has maybe one of the worst characters I've ever seen in the William H. Macy character, and his no depths that he won't sink to further his own alcoholism. So, I mean, it's like you look at shows like Breaking Bad and, you know, like Ozark, and people are like, oh, they're really doing bad stuff. But on a more sort of believable, grounded level, this guy is maybe the worst character I've ever seen. So I think that's worth a look for anyone who's interested in writing terrible characters. What else have I been? I've been reading Double Indemnity, actually. I got a published copy of Double Indemnity, the screenplay, which is really interesting to look at because it's written in a very old, the old screenplay format, which has lots of interesting deviations from what we're used to today, and some of which I wonder if we should bring back. I want to write a script in this old style. I want to write a noir that looks like this script looks, because it looks really cool.
I'll have to check that out. That sounds awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, everybody, for joining us for this Pro Roundtable Screenwriters Network. Really appreciate you guys sharing your wealth of knowledge with us. And I know I have definitely picked up a lot, and hopefully I'm a little bit better writer today than I was about an hour and a half ago. For those that are still listening, why don't you throw some clap emojis in social for our panelists? Since we can't clap in real life, I guess we can.
Yay!
All right. Thank you, everybody. And we'll catch you next time.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to our first ever Professionals Roundtable. And a big thanks to Mark Mazur for hosting and all of our professionals for taking part. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, share it on social media, join the Discord server, and please consider supporting us on Patreon so you can get access to that sweet, sweet bonus content. By the way, I do have word that Mark will be getting a new microphone soon, so hopefully we'll be hearing more of these roundtables in the future. I'm your host, Smish, saying peace out and keep on writing.